Hi, I'm Dr. Chris Cannon, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining us in today's educational activity that's entitled Getting to the Heart of Underdiagnosis and Undertreatment of Nonvalvular Atrial Fibrillation, Integrating Optimal Screening, Team-Based Care, and Digital Health Tools. This activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, an award-winning accredited provider of continuing medical education for clinicians across the globe. And as a unique feature, there are several really neat features that are being offered by CME Outfitters. They're providing resources for both patients and providers. So first, CME Outfitters would like to try and integrate digital health tools, and so they partnered up with a group called PAC Health, and will offer to 75 patients personalized digital health coaching for up to 3 months. Then for clinicians, CME Outfitters will be offering an e-consult service at no cost for up to 100 clinicians who sign up. The group Arista MD will be providing the e-consult service to clinicians at no cost for a 30-day period. And then finally, CME Outfitters has developed two patient education tools. One really nice whiteboard animation that describes nonvalvular atrial fibrillation, its symptoms, risk factors, and treatment, as well as a downloadable list of questions that the patient could ask their doctor or healthcare professional regarding nonvalvular atrial fibrillation. So today we will discuss some of the value of these different types of digital tools later in the show, and encourage you to then check out these options and register for the services for either for yourself or your patients. And then a last reminder, beyond this being CME, in 2018, this is the first year of the MIPS program for reporting to CMS. And part of meeting your requirements is that one needs to have quality payment program participation in quality improvement activities. And today's program has been designed to meet those requirements. And so your active participation in the polling questions, asking a question, completing the evaluation and the post-test is the first step of that process. So after today's activity to incorporate these clinical improvements, we're hoping that we'll discuss and you'll get in 3 to 4 months questions that will follow up on the discussion. And CME Outfitters will send you that survey, and that will fulfill the data collection requirement for this reporting. And they'll then send you a confirmation letter. So, want to introduce us as a group. My name is Chris Cannon. I'm the education director at the Cardiovascular Medicine Institute, or Innovation at Brigham Women's Hospital, and a professor at Harvard Medical School. And looking forward to an active discussion that will focus on strategies and tools for improving care. And we'll begin with a good friend, colleague, and world expert, Dr. Elaine Heilig, who's the director of the Thrombosis and Anticoagulation Service at Boston Medical Center and a professor of medicine at Boston University School of Medicine here in Boston. Also want to introduce Dr. Deepak Bhatt, another good friend and colleague, and he's the executive director of interventional cardiovascular programs at Brigham Women's Hospital and the Heart and Vascular Center, and also a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. So want to welcome both of you for this terrific program, and we look forward to being a global community with all of you who are joining online. And so, what we'll be talking about first is a segment to look at how to identify high-risk patients who could develop nonvalvular atrial fibrillation in our practices. So the learning objective of this segment is to examine the significance of identifying patients at high risk for developing nonvalvular atrial fibrillation in a primary care setting where they then might benefit from anticoagulation therapy. So we'll begin with a question for everyone, and you'll see on the screen here a question of which of the following is unlikely to be part of the clinical presentation of a patient with atrial fibrillation. A is headache, fatigue, lightheadedness, no symptoms, or I'm not sure, and put don't know. So we'll begin with prevalence. Elaine, perhaps you could start us off with looking at this, really a classic slide of looking at the prevalence over age of atrial fibrillation.
Sure, Chris. So I think this is really the reason that we're here today. The prevalence of atrial fibrillation actually increases with age. As you can see on this slide, which is a study that came out of the Kaiser Permanente in California, Northern California, and you can see that the prevalence actually, once we hit ages of 75 up to 80, really start to increase, I think, quite dramatically, 7%, 10%, 11%, actually higher estimates have come out, and even more recent studies on prevalence, upwards of 15% of individuals over age 80. These are patients in my practice. I see this demographic a lot. Another important, interesting fact that I don't think we fully understand is why men at any age seem to have more risk of developing atrial fibrillation. But with that being said, if you look at the older age groups, I mean, women numerically end up having more numbers of AF because we tend to still be living longer. And women actually have a higher risk of stroke in AFib. So it's, you know, we can't be forgetting women in atrial fibrillation, because I think overall it affects really all of us as we get older.
Yeah, it's a striking thing. And I guess the other part of this is that there are a lot of people that have AFib, but we just don't know it. And do you want to comment on the underdiagnosed patient?
Right, so, you know, the question that you had asked our audience was, what are the symptoms of atrial fibrillation? And I think this is the real challenge in general medicine primary care, because oftentimes patients don't know that they're in atrial fibrillation. Many studies have shown, you know, maybe 10 to 12% in the cardiovascular health study actually knew, these patients knew they were in AF. There are some symptoms that might trigger you thinking about atrial fibrillation, but let me just say that most patients don't even appreciate that they're in it. And here on this slide, I think it's provocative, because when we look at the undiagnosed AF, these are not small numbers. It's not 1% or 2%, and it's about 11% overall, 1 in 10, maybe even 1 in 9, 1 in 8 of us is sort of running around not appreciating that we're in this rhythm, and it especially, certainly most important, I think, in the older age group, over 65, 70, because that's when we start to see the stroke risk increase as well.
Wow. And we've talked about prevalence as sort of a snapshot. What about lifetime risk, Deepak? That is even probably greater than what we get at a snapshot.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really the million-dollar question, in a sense, especially from a patient's perspective. And this slide really nicely shows what the lifetime risk is for atrial fibrillation. And it's pretty high in men, it's pretty high in women. It's pretty high, in fact, at all ages. It's true there's a lot more of it in general as people get older. But even if you talked about men and women greater than or equal to the age of 40, one out of four, essentially a quarter of them, will develop atrial fibrillation. So that just shows you what the lifetime burden is of atrial fibrillation. And another way of looking at that is that there's a 1 in 6 lifetime risk of developing atrial fibrillation if one is currently free of it. So bottom line is probably one of us is going to develop atrial fibrillation. It's just how the numbers work out.
Yeah, and I guess this has been something that I certainly am seeing just in my practice. Almost everyone seems to have AFib. Of course, that's not the case, but has it been changing over time?
Yes, you can see even from the slide that's being shown now that the prevalence of atrial fibrillation has been rising in the United States, and it's estimated that it's going to increase by about twofold by the year 2030, such that over 12 million people have atrial fibrillation. And in fact, atrial fibrillation is a global problem. The slide shows the United States, but this is true throughout the world, as you know, people are living longer, and that's the case in the U.S., but it's in fact true everywhere in the world, really. So there's going to be a lot more AFib.
You know, another important point here is that, you know, we're living longer. We're actually seeing 80s and 90s now. The definition of elder, I think, has recently changed. And, you know, as we're living longer with our hypertension, with our high cholesterol, hopefully living longer with our diabetes and the metabolic syndrome, that we're seeing this phenomenon Something that happens within our hearts and our vasculature. And clearly obesity is another really important factor in this, I don't want to use the word epidemic, but we need to help our patients develop healthy lifestyles, weight loss programs, because, I mean, there are some real risks to being obese, and that's underlying some of this expansion.
Yeah, and I'd say that's probably underappreciated in terms of a risk to develop atrial fibrillation, but, you know, well seen. Certainly then, once you have atrial fibrillation, the outcomes are what we worry about, and stroke prevention is sort of key. But you have some neat data, Deepak, from the REACH registry on overall cardiovascular outcomes.
Sure. So these are data from the International REACH Registry, over 60,000 patients either with atherothrombosis or at risk for it. So having a history of things like prior history of angina or claudication, that sort of thing, or just patients with multiple risk factors like diabetes, hypertension. But at any rate, when one compares those with atrial fibrillation versus without atrial fibrillation and here follows them for about 4 years or so, you can see there's about a twofold higher rate of cardiovascular death, MI, or stroke, so a doubling in the risk associated with atrial fibrillation here, going from about 13% to 24%. Now, not all that is caused by atrial fibrillation. That is, atrial fibrillation obviously can cause some proportion of cardioembolic strokes. It can cause the occasional MI from an embolus, for example, or type 2 MI just from a really fast heart rate. But what this is really showing us is that atrial fibrillation, apart from its being causative, as I mentioned, actually is associated with a lot of other similar risk factors for atherothrombosis, the things Elaine was just mentioning, things like hypertension, diabetes, for that matter, heart failure, obesity. They all tend to cluster together and go together. So if a patient has atrial fibrillation, obviously you want to focus on the atrial fibrillation as a modifiable risk factor for cardioembolic and systemic embolism. But on the other hand, one also realizes it's just a generalized marker of badness. Think about their other cardiovascular risk factors as well.
It's a terrific, you know, if it's one in four over a four-year period, that's a pretty common problem that they're going to be facing some bad
Absolutely.
Outcome.
And just to make clear, I may not have mentioned, these are stable outpatients who are enrolled in this registry. So these aren't hospitalized people that are really sick. They're just people sitting in the office feeling well.
Yeah. Well, what about the cost to the healthcare system? That's obviously, if it's tracking with their risk, the costs are going to be high.
Yeah, that's an important point. Obviously, in this country, we're in a continual debate about healthcare costs. They're rising. How can we rein them in? And I'm not sure we'll figure that out in the next 45 minutes here, but atrial fibrillation is definitely a big part of that risk. You know, in the U.S., some figures are shown here on the slide. You can see really the costs go into the billions of dollars, consisting of inpatient atrial fibrillation costs, outpatient and pharmacy costs, and then various indirect costs associated with this. So, you know, in total, for example, data from 2005 shows a $26 billion cost associated to the system with that. And that's, of course, only gone up since that time because of the increased prevalence of atrial fibrillation and also some newer therapies for it. So lots of cost to atrial fibrillation beyond just the human cost of consequences such as stroke and other embolic problems. There's also just the financial cost.
Yeah, and I guess we also have seen the estimates of what would be the cost of all those undiagnosed patients, many of whom will first present with a stroke, where that, you know, can be a terrible outcome, but also obviously more cost to the health system.
Well, that's a great point, because that last slide was just capturing the cost of known treated atrial fibrillation. Yeah, the untreated part that presents as a disabling stroke wasn't captured in that slide.
Well, the risk stratification we talk about in a lot of diseases, but probably no better place here than in atrial fibrillation. Do you want to comment on the sort of evolution of our risk scores and what you use currently?
So, you know, it's important to remember that atrial fibrillation in and of itself increases the risk of stroke fivefold, roughly, no matter what age you are. But the reason that we don't, in the guidelines, don't really promulgate use of anticoagulation until you get into these other CHADS and CHAS-VASc risk factors is because it really tracks with these factors that are raising the hypercoagulability or the clotting of our blood. So the CHADS was what we were originally using. That was really heart failure, hypertension, age over 75, diabetes, and prior stroke, with prior stroke always being 2 points. We've since moved on to a CHADS-VASc stroke risk scoring scheme, which basically now includes age 65 to 74 as a point, which clearly makes sense because we don't suddenly have our 75th birthday and have this risk of stroke. It's a continuum. And we also included females, so women, especially if you're over 65, some probably menopausal effects on our platelets and other things. And then in addition to that, the CHADS-VASc, that vascular part of it is really incorporating atherosclerosis, so peripheral arterial disease, coronary artery disease. And I think that's important because there's inflammation that can actually track systemically with those entities and I'm sure also increases the risk of stroke. You know, I think that probably the biggest advantage of this CHADS-VASc score is it enabled us to really discriminate across 9 points the risk of a stroke and atrial fibrillation such that, you know, the lowest risk, we really now, I think, have a handle on the lowest risk group of individuals, and that's what this CHADS-VASc helps us do. So, you know, globally, we now, all of the groups are embracing the CHADS-VASc score. And I think, you know, we will be going over, you know, when to anticoagulate subsequently. But, you know, once you hit a CHADS-VASc score of 2, and you can see the points assigned for each of these, that's really considered absolutely you really need to be discussing and prescribing an anticoagulant for those patients.
Well, it's terrific, and this has really been a wonderful evolution. We saw an interesting study looking at this in the undiagnosed, at least, AFib patient, and this also seems to track in terms of the percentage of patients who have higher scores.
Right, and this biologically, we all went to medical school. I mean, this makes sense to me that, you know, if you think that there are some changes that are occurring within the left atrium, like fibrosis, inflammation, that those factors may be triggering this unstable or this arrhythmia, this atrial fibrillation. So it doesn't really surprise me that when you look at those individuals without AFib, but you look at their CHADS scores or their CHADS-VASc scores that within that highest risk population who you might be thinking of screening. And here you can see this study where 56% of undiagnosed cases had a CHADS score of 2 or greater and 77% had a CHADS score of 1 or greater. And what I failed to mention on the previous slide is that what is the stroke risk then? And this is really the bottom line. Is that with the CHADS-VASc score, you can appreciate here if your score is 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9, the annual risk of an ischemic stroke, even if your CHADS-VASc score is 4, is already at about 8%. If you're looking at a CHADS-VASc score, you know, even at 2, which seems like, well, you know, Elaine, that seems awfully low. Why are we giving, you know, these blood thinners? It's a risk of maybe 4%. That's 4 out of 100, 2 out of 50, 1 in 25 that may have a stroke. And again, remembering the bottom line with these strokes is that they're associated with the 24% mortality at 30 days. So, you know, Chris, these are not just small, like minor strokes where you're like most of these, I don't say most, let's say 24% of the time, these strokes are devastating enough that individual's no longer with us in 30 days. And for me, that's the bottom line.
Yeah. Well, let's circle back to the clinical presentation. And Deepak, what kind of things do you actually look for risk factor symptom-wise for patients sort of screening, so to speak, for AFib?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, again, a bottom line perspective would be that there's just a lot of symptoms that atrial fibrillation can be associated with. And as we alluded to before, of course, there's a lot of people out there with asymptomatic atrial fibrillation. And even the asymptomatic part can be pretty bad and causing problems to the myocardium that the person is completely unaware of because they're asymptomatic. So, you know, that's an important part of it all. But in terms of presentations, you know, palpitations is what a lot of times we think of and ask about. But there's really just a lot of other things, too. Dyspnea can occur, chest pain, of course, lightheadedness. syncope, fatigue, and of course there are a lot of things that cause fatigue, but in an older person who is fatigued and sort of it's out of the blue without another good explanation, hopefully someone thinks to, you know, check the heart rate and rhythm. Obviously, thromboembolism is the feared complication of atrial fibrillation, and as Elaine pointed out, there's a proportion of that that'll be fatal. Mm-hmm. So that's really the challenge with atrial fibrillation. So screening for symptoms can be useful, and you know, these are all things that would be asked for in a typical primary care or wellness visit. But on the other hand, it's easy to miss atrial fibrillation.
Yeah. Well, this kind of brings us back to the question that we posed, and we do have some answers. Again, the question was which of the symptoms was unlikely to be part of the clinical presentation, and so the audience answered 45% headache, and so that's the right answer. That's not a typical presentation, but then fatigue and lightheadedness, no symptoms at all were noted in 21%, but that is a common finding that people just will show up.
Yeah.
I've had that in the office that suddenly I look down at their EKG and they're in AFib and they're just chatting with me about their cholesterol and it's like, wait a minute, we've got a whole other thing we've got to worry about. So I think it's a good thing for us to remember that it's sort of a vague presentation. It's not sort of a classic MI type. All right. Well, why don't we move on to our second segment? And here the learning objective for this segment is to look at what are ways that we could increase the rate of detection of non-valvular atrial fibrillation by looking either at opportunistic screening or more systematic screening in a primary care setting with our ultimate goal of trying to reduce the risk of stroke. And so we'll again begin with a question. And here we're getting into a little bit more newfangled area of how to do screening with lots of different tools. And so we'll ask the question of which of the following is currently recommended in guidelines for routine systematic screening for atrial fibrillation? A would be at 12-lead ECG, B, smartphone apps, automated blood pressure measurement, apnea, hypnea index, or none of those things recommended. Well, Elaine, why don't we turn to you and get an early answer on what is in the current recommendations for screening?
So, incredible timing of this program. There is a body of individuals that sort of looks at evidence, at least the extant evidence, and comes up with a promulgation, usually fairly conservative, about where they think, you know, we should be putting our investment. So that the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force released the final recommendation statement on screening for atrial fibrillation with electrocardiography, and the task force found insufficient evidence on screening for atrial fibrillation with electrocardiogram to prevent stroke. And, you know, I think that the group is charged with, you know, a finite, you know, amount of money in the healthcare system. Like, how can we make this one cost effective? And I think cost effective, any screening program, it's going to be most cost effective if you're limiting it to the individuals that are really at the highest risk of having the entity. So we've kind of already discussed about, you know, really large groups of individuals that have that higher CHADS-VASc score. And then the other thing, when you look at that sentence, the task force found insufficient evidence on screening with electrocardiogram to prevent strokes. And like here, you know, I just realized that you can diagnose AFib, but if you're not doing the next things that you need to be doing with your atrial fibrillation, i.e. seeing your physician and inquiring about my CHADS-VASc score and should I be on an anticoagulant, what are my risks, then you actually may not ever be able to demonstrate that the detection of it is preventing stroke. So, you know, I think that the screening literature, the screening studies are really just coming to fore now because we haven't been focused on the pre-stroke care and diagnosis as much as we are, I would say, in the last 5 years. So I can't imagine that this isn't going to change or be shaped over the next few years.
That's terrific. And Deepak, we have ECG screening for, you know, young athletes, and certainly. And what do you think about sort of ECG? What should be the threshold for adding that into a doctor visit of any type?
I mean, it's a great question, and as Elaine sort of alluded to, if you're doing the annual ECG on everybody, the cumulative costs of the healthcare system, you know, aren't trivial. On the other hand, I have a little bit of a different viewpoint because as an interventionalist, there's nothing more that I hate than getting called from the emergency department saying, look, presume new left bundle branch, take them to the cath lab. And if there were an old ECG, it would make that aspect of my life easier. So I kind of do like the ECG as part of that annual visit for at least the middle-aged or older individual, but will concede that there's no data supporting it. It could lead to a series of expensive tests, potentially even leading to complications, including very rarely major complications if you see a left bundle, as I just alluded to, but the person's asymptomatic and now you get a stress test, which probably you shouldn't. That shows something. They get a cath, maybe they have a bleed, very rarely a stroke. So, you know, I get it that just the non-evidence-based screening can have downsides. But on the other hand, you do pick up some folks with atrial fibrillation. It does give you a baseline. So it's as Elaine said, it's all how you use it. If you then, you know, get an abnormal ECG and cath everybody, then that's probably not a good thing to do, but if you just use it for what you meant to use it for, that is to establish a baseline, maybe look for AFib, you know, even though that goes against the guidelines, I don't think that's unreasonable.
With this sort of what do we do here in screening, there's not much evidence. We'll touch on a few trials. What would you see as sort of the goal of screening? Are there any people that have looked at the potential?
So, you know, I think that there's an interesting study that was published not really very long ago, which is why I'm a little surprised that the U.S. Preventative Service Task Force, that here we have data from this RIC stroke and registry. And for me, as a practicing internist, this is all I need to know. In this study, they found that about 33% of ischemic strokes were due to atrial fibrillation. So, and only 16% of those had received an anticoagulant in the previous 6 months. In addition to that, 8% of patients in this registry had atrial fibrillation that was not previously known. Yeah. And that's actually a low number because I believe most of the literature I've read has stated about 15% of all strokes are actually the first clinical manifestation of atrial fibrillation. And I would hope that that would not be my first manifestation or clinical manifestation of my AF would be a stroke. And then another, I think, very important thing to grasp is that in this study, 8 to 28% of patients with ischemic stroke noticed their symptoms when they woke up from sleep, which this concept of a wake-up stroke, about 12% from other literature, I think it's about 12% of the time that an individual has a stroke, probably for different reasons, cortisol changes, whatever. But I think these are the reasons that I would want to know to prevent these potentially devastating outcomes, and then hopefully, again, get the therapy that you and your physician family members decide is the most important for you.
Yeah. Well, screening definitely can be, and there's sort of two broad approaches. And Deepak, do you want to touch on sort of targeted versus systematic and sort of the opportunities in each approach?
Yeah, absolutely. So targeted screening really refers to identifying the appropriate setting and cohort of people to assess. Examples might be a flu clinic, for example. A hypertension clinic, that might be a little higher yield, in fact, just because of the fact that hypertension and AFib can travel together. And you know, other sorts of places might be a sleep apnea clinic, because again, there's a proportion of folks with sleep apnea that will have AFib. The two are interrelated. And you know, those are just some examples. Opportunistic screening, on the other hand, could occur in any setting. So a walk-in clinic, community pharmacy, some have advocated that approach, or different sort of health care affair events. I mean, that can be a way of picking up some AFib. All are potentially useful. None are really evidence-based. That is, nobody's done a million-patient study and said, you know, walk into a flu clinic and you're better off having your AFib detected than not. It's just sort of the challenge. For sure, people that have their AFib detected, I think it's a good thing if it's sustained AFib. I think the challenge is, you know, some people have more transient episodes of AFib. Some people may be misdiagnosed as having AFib in these settings when they don't really have it. And there's a potential for downstream unnecessary testing. That's the downside.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And are there people that you'd think about targeting sort of based on clinical or, you know, demographics or their prior history that would be reasonable to think about the screening?
Yeah, I think so. I think people over the age of 65 makes a lot of sense to do it there. And by screening, I mean, at a minimum, I would like to think people are still doing the physical exam, even though that doesn't have a lot of evidence either. Maybe that should go out of the guidelines too. But, you know, I'd like to think people are doing a careful pulse check for both rate and rhythm, and blood pressure checks, that sort of thing. So that would happen. And I think an EKG is part of that. I don't think that's such a bad thing as part of the annual physical. I'll probably get in trouble for saying that because it violates the guidelines and everything. But, you know, it had been standard practice for a long time. I think people that are just at high cardiovascular risk, even if they're not over 65, it makes sense. As I showed from the REACH registry data, a lot of those risk factors and AFib travel together. So I think it makes sense if someone's had hypertension for a couple of decades, even if they're under 65, you know, there I would really be concerned about AFib. And there I think, you know, the threshold for screening really should be much lower in terms of an ECG. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are other things too, other sorts of heart. Obviously, if they have heart failure, I imagine they're going to get a 12-lead ECG anyway, but if for some reason they're not, they should looking for AFib and other sorts of potential abnormalities, and sleep apnea, kidney disease. I might throw in people that are diabetic or obese as well.
Yeah. And then the other approach would be to make this a little bit more systematic. And there have been some studies that are starting and others that we'll touch on getting going. But do you want to comment on this as sort of a systematic approach?
Yeah, this is some work that was published in Circulation a few years ago, the Stroke Stop study in 7,000 or so people around the age of 75. And what they did was use self-activated handheld single-lead ECGs, and that returned a diagnosis of AF in about 3% of all patients just over 2 weeks. So those are people that wouldn't have known they had AF were it not for this. So I think that that's potentially a useful approach. And again, the question that remains unanswered is, how actionable is the information? What would you do with it? But, you know, that critique could be made of every test that we're getting, you know, stress tests and so forth. I mean, you're just getting stress tests in healthy 20-year-olds and they're coming back abnormal every now and then and a false positive and you're cathing them. You know, that would be a bad judgment of how to use a non-invasive modality. So I think this is an interesting study.
Yeah. Right, and it's important to validate that diagnosis, as it clearly states here with the electrocardiogram. And I think what's a little remarkable about this study is that 3% in 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's a lot.
2 weeks is a very short interval. So I do think that there's a population in which it makes sense to really be a little more systematic in the screening approach.
Yeah. Yeah, in the absence of anything else, I mean, age is always a good marker of risk. And obviously, the burden of AF is particularly high in older folks, and then the risk of stroke is also substantial.
Yeah. And if we did adopt some type of a screening program, well, how could that impact on outcomes? What would be sort of the play of this?
Well, I mean, I think the obvious, I mean, what is our most feared outcome with atrial fibrillation? Well, it's stroke. And I do think that would be a very important you know, continuum of care if you were diagnosed to really, you know, go and seek the advice that you need and the treatment that you need. Clearly, for me, it's yet another opportunity to tell you, you know, Chris, you need to really work on that 75 pounds that, you know, you, not you, Chris, but that you put on, because, I mean, that is going to be fueling the burden. You know, there may be more atrial fibrillation, and I just really think it's an opportunity to bring our patients back to the table. You know, this is where you are. Let's see if we can't have some real impact here with your lifespan.
Yeah. All right, well, let's go back to the polling question that we had. And here we were looking at which is recommended currently for routine systematic screening. And the audience said 60% 12-lead ECG. So I think it's the Deepak-Bhatt guidelines here of, and I think very thoughtful, but I think from a sort of public health screening, there isn't currently that evidence that you'd be doing way more ECGs than they thought would be cost effective.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it reflects the wisdom of the crowds, right? I mean, that's what people are actually doing. But it's not the right answer for, you know, a board exam or something like that. I mean, they're, you know, the task force guidelines are very clear not to do routine non-directed ECGs.
Yeah. Well, this field, I think, is evolving quickly. And, you know, there's been news of, you know, the Apple Watch was the latest screening tool, but there are a lot of different tools. You want to sort of touch on the array of things that we could bring to
bear? You know, well, the one thing I really want to emphasize, and I feel strongly about it, is, you know, when a patient comes into my office, I mean, my God, unconscionable to not be checking vital signs. I think that's just a critical basic part of caring for individuals. So, I mean, the heart rate, clearly, the regularity of the pulse, because I would say most of the patients in the last 6 months that I've diagnosed with atrial fibrillation, it was in the office when they were coming in for a different reason. I noted the irregular pulse, listened to the heart, was able to get it on a 12-lead EKG. But again, that's a screening bias for the patients that actually come in for sort of a routine check every 6 months or once a year, what have you. But clearly the automated blood pressure measurements is important, a single lead ECG screening. I think with the difficulty in this whole field right now is that if, like, sensitivity means, you know, how many of these entities are you able to pick up? That's your sensitivity. So it makes sense to me that the higher you want your sensitivity to not miss one of these cases, the specificity or the false positives is often the trade-off, because now you're opening up the universe of all of the things that might within there have some atrial fibrillation. And I think, you know, some of these high estimates of specificity, I do question just a little bit, because it's hard to have, you know, the 99 and the 99 when it comes to something like an arrhythmia. Yeah. I don't know, Deepak, if you agree with that, but...
I agree.
Yeah, and we have one of the devices actually has gone through a formal FDA approval. And so this, as pictured here, is the AliveCor device that does a single lead ECG. And there are then as a watch version of this, and then the Apple Watch would be the single lead ECG. And to have a diagnostic algorithm in the software is really part of the key. But I think, as you say, we have sort of the initial studies gone through FDA approval, but now we need sort of the real world, bigger studies. There are other sort of more simple things. And Deepak, I think you've been playing around with a heart rate monitor on your...
And, you know, so first let me just say, I don't have any sort of financial interest in this app or company. I only downloaded this 5 minutes before the program. It was easy to download, it was free. And I'm not saying to do it, but the reality is it doesn't matter what I think, because patients are going to be downloading these apps and using them. Not just patients, even just healthy people walking around. So there's going to be a ton of people. So it doesn't really matter whether I think it's a good idea. It doesn't matter what any of us think with that respect. This is the reality. It's the future, right? I mean, it's everybody's got an iPhone or something like that. So let me go ahead now. And again, this was just downloaded for a free about 5 minutes before this program started. And I've got my finger on where the camera is, and I'm going to hit the start button here. This is the cardio app. Just went to the app store and downloaded it.
So you got a good pulse there, it looks like, you know?
It does. It's interesting. When I did it before, it was 60. I guess even without knowing it, my pulse is up because we're on live TV, I guess.
Yeah, but, there you go. Yeah.
But it was about 58, 60 before. Yeah. Very interesting. But at any rate, you know, this isn't to detect AFib. This is just to detect the heart rate, and it shows the heart rate. It does show, you know, the rhythm in a sense. But it's not really designed for atrial fibrillation detection.
But, you know,
at least
the
tip-off
would be oftentimes a rapid heart rate, how atrial fibrillation often presents. That's what the palpitations are, the feeling of breathlessness. Sometimes this feeling of lightheadedness, you know, can be because your heart rate is too fast, and that is also sort of a marker of AF. So important, just that.
Yeah. Well, I think it is the future. Just yesterday in clinic, one of the patients had one of the, the iPhone watch or the smartwatch, and we were looking through the last 2 months of her heart rate, and it's just kind of a whole new piece of data that we can use in the office.
It is, but of course, it'll be a mixed blessing for us from the physician side, right? Because it could lead to us being inundated with data, some of which could be actionable, but in a sea of data that's probably not actionable.
And I think that's a key thing. This was an interesting study looking at community screening. Do you want to comment on this one? This was trying to look at using an iPhone ECG, but in pharmacies. And so you had mentioned, Deepak, sort of the one of the systematic but ways of just if people show up in a pharmacy, you can go to the little booth on the side. And this picked up a few cases, I think. It was an interesting study overall. One of the questions that comes up is then who takes action? And that is building a system around this, I think, is a key part of it. If something is diagnosed, who gets alerted? One of the system we looked at earlier, you have to log in who's your doctor to get any kind of alerts.
And right, this is like a panic value. Right, and I think that's obviously the critical piece, and that may have been really what the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force was touching on, is that, it's great if everyone wants to be involved, they should be, and your health, for goodness sakes, the most important thing is your health. But if you have that, you really do need to act on it, and there needs to be a loop or no fragmentation in the care of that once it's diagnosed. And I think what you're doing and how you're acting on that is part of the reason they may not have shown yet decrease in outcomes, especially stroke.
Yeah, because you can go to a pharmacy right now and get your blood pressure checked for free in many places. There's little cuffs you can stick your arm in. I like to go in and do that myself. But do people always act on that information? It's really what Elaine said, the loop has to be closed. Maybe I'm checking my blood pressure is high if I don't do anything, or if there's no prompt to do anything.
Yeah.
So the information I think potentially could be useful, but more important is how is that information utilized, integrated with that person's overall healthcare.
Right, and I think the other interesting point here too is like, what about the sea of people who aren't digitally savvy, or people that really like don't want to be tethered to this type of monitoring of self? And we can't, lose sight of, all of those individuals that really just this may not be part of their approach to their health or whatever. So I think if we would find really super convincing data, then we would then maybe say to our patients, maybe we should be thinking about some of this stuff, even though you don't currently have your laptop or you don't have other things. So it's important. The tech savvy, I think, is important to break down those barriers.
Yeah. All right. Although, those things are changing. That is, with the younger generations, kids in middle school now have cell phones, maybe even grammar school. So there's just such a wide penetration of these handheld devices and such comfort with even sharing data, it seems like, maybe a little bit too much comfort in terms of not worried about the privacy aspects of sharing data. So I think in the future there'll be such penetration of these devices globally and such comfort with having data downloaded that, it's going to be part of the future of healthcare. We've just got to figure out, can we do it in a way that's more scientific instead of just everybody's recording everything and just sending everything to their doctor or not sending it? How can we use this information and prove that it actually improves outcomes?
Yeah. I'll just share here, the this is an evolving thing. This was a neat study from UCSF, but 51 patients and, had very high sensitivity and specificity, but I think we have to bear in mind this is in carefully selected patients. And so I think we'll look forward to larger studies in this area. Another study looked at wearable continuous ECG monitors, and those have gotten nice and small, like a oversized Band-Aid, but was studied very carefully in a large study and was able to pick up, new AFib in just about 4% of people. I think this is a new way that we can, these are ordered in the office, at least, I do in some patients.
So, Chris, one thing I would like to add is that, one of the groups, the cryptogenic stroke group, I think is a critical group as well, where I think we have very compelling evidence from the Crystal AF study that among individuals who present with a stroke, you've looked for AFib, you haven't found atrial defibrillation. The patient's been on tele during that stroke admission. But individuals in that study who had some type of an implantable, right under the chest muscle, subcutaneous, a tiny monitor, that they were able to really pick up AFib even at the 30-day mark, 6-month mark. I mean, and it wasn't trivial. I believe it was up to at least, was it 12% in crystal AF?
Yeah, it was pretty high.
So, I mean, different population, but again, I think we're moving, especially for a stroke population, because that would change management.
Yeah, well, I want to thank you. This is a rapidly evolving space, but, it's really promising, and it makes sense. So as Rachel Maddow says, watch this space. So we've got to stay tuned for that. So, all right, well, let's move on to our third section where we'll have a learning objective of aiming to try and implement guideline-directed therapy for appropriate use of oral anticoagulation for the patients who have non-valvular AFib, again, with the goal of reducing stroke. And so we'll begin with a question here. If we have a patient with a prior stroke who comes into the office and has an ECG showing AFib, what would not be the appropriate next step? So A is refer to a cardiologist, B, assess their risk of thromboembolism, C, initiate therapy with antiplatelet therapy for stroke prevention, and D, initiate treatment with oral anticoagulant therapy. So why don't we turn to guidelines, and we'll start in Europe. They have more colorful guideline figures in the European guidelines. So Elaine, do you want to walk us through the...
Sure. So these are the European Society of Cardiology 2012 guidelines. You can see I'd already mentioned this lone atrial fibrillation. If you're young, less than 65 years, no structural heart disease, that even in the presence of atrial fibrillation, again, because you don't have all of those extra risk factors, the risk of stroke is really just not high enough to justify being on an anticoagulant. You know, absolutely. I mean, you need to know the CHA2DS2-VASc score, and how you figure that out right there in the office should be second nature. For individuals like all of us caring for this patient population. But here we have, if your CHA2DS2-VASc score is 1, the European guidelines recommend an oral anticoagulant or suggest, clearly with the patient preferences in mind. And if you're 2 or above, absolutely an oral anticoagulant therapy is what's recommended. And here in the 2012 guidelines, they actually had a box about calculating this HAS-BLED score, which I think I'm going to talk about on a subsequent slide that's really looking at bleeding risk. And here with the European guidelines, there was a preference for NOAC use, but clearly vitamin K antagonists providing, you can keep that INR in the range where it needs to be effective, that certainly was another option, but with the preference for the NOAC, at least in 2012.
Yeah. And then what about, what are our current guidelines here in the U.S.?
So if we sort of look at the 2014 American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association, Heart Rhythm Society guidelines, I mean, I would really say they're pretty much the same except for the aspirin, and, our audience can read through each of these. But the CHA2DS2-VASc score of 1... In the United States, it's still like aspirin versus don't do anything versus, an anticoagulant, and that's really sort of, I think, a debate right now. We probably all have different opinions about the CHA2DS2-VASc1. I would be tending to use anticoagulation in even those patients, but again, it's sort of looking at the whole patient comprehensive care. So that was definitely a bit of a departure. And then in addition to that, again, I mean, I direct a large, anticoagulation clinic. There certainly are individuals on warfarin, but you really need to be sure that INR is in the 2-3 range. I think most of the metrics now are 70% of the time, which isn't always easy to achieve, but I think that's right. Really. So CHA2DS2-VASc score of 2 above, anticoagulation, CHA2DS2-VASc score of 1. Whether this will change with the next iteration, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and aspirin sort of in or out, that's been coming out of the guidelines. And are there subsequent sort of consensus documents on antiplatelet therapy in the
Well, certainly patients? You can speak to the coronary, but for atrial fibrillation, I think that the field has clearly, and I think dramatically, shifted away from aspirin. And the main reason is because when you look at the older population, let's say 70, 75 or above, the bleeding risk on aspirin actually is very near or almost equivalent. And there are two studies for our viewers, the BAFTA trial and the Averroes trial. I think were both studies that looked at aspirin in an anticoagulant, and they were both, I think, very sea change of how we think about aspirin because of the bleeding risk in the older population. So you're not buying much on safety there.
Yeah, it's probably just been an underappreciation of the fact that aspirin, especially in that age group, carries a substantial risk, and that anticoagulants, whether it's well-managed warfarin or particular or NOAC, that's renally adjusted appropriately, is really quite safe. You know, you mentioned that we might differ here, but Chad's asked one. I myself would typically use a NOAC if there was no contraindication, the person was at low bleeding risk.
Yeah.
Would you
yeah.
do different,
yeah,
Chris?
Yeah, no, same. I'm definitely in the treat. I just picture that atrium not moving. And so, all right, well, why don't we come back to the polling question? And again, this was a patient arriving in your office who's had a prior stroke and AFib on the EKG. What would not be the right next step? And so we have the full array of refer to a cardiologist as the wrong thing to do, 25% of people. Then assess the risk of thromboembolism as the wrong thing. I think that is a key step to do. Initiate antiplatelet therapy. This was the plurality, I guess, at 38%. I think that is the correct answer of what not to
right.
do on the basis of really lack of efficacy for stroke prevention mm-hmm. from atrial fibrillation. And then I think we're relearning the bleeding risk there.
Yep.
So.
All
right, well, why don't we quickly go through then, you know, the NOACs have been a really wonderful story. This is sort of the timeline of, we now have in the United States four approved for treatment of patients with atrial fibrillation. And so this becomes a wonderful set of options for us. And Deepak, do you want to go through sort of the algorithm of how we treat these patients?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think the NOACs really have been a major development in the care of atrial fibrillation. And at this point in time, the majority of new prescriptions in the United States and in many regions of the world for atrial fibrillation is a NOAC. It's no longer warfarin. So things have really changed. And I think that's supported by the data. The data are really quite robust for NOACs, primarily due to the fact that they reduce the risk of intracranial hemorrhage, even versus well-controlled warfarin, even when the time and therapeutic range is high. So again, assuming renal function is adjusted for, it's hard to beat NOACs. This particular slide just shows one sort of algorithm, and just to remind everybody, mechanical heart valves or moderate or severe native mitral valve stenosis, what I just said doesn't apply. Those patients should be on carefully monitored warfarin. That's the standard of care and isn't about to imminently change. There's some small trials ongoing.
And just to clarify, this is actually the updated European guidelines, the 2016 guidelines. And the purpose of putting this here was just to show that Hazblitt score is now no longer being put in as the preemptory box before you make a decision, but really to really do a checklist and figure out what is my patient maybe doing, what types of behaviors, what's happening that may increase the risk of bleeding. And, you know, certainly non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications, ibuprofen, are contraindicated if you're on an anticoagulant. They raise the risk of GI bleeding 19-fold. So I tell all of my patients, we need to find something else for you for very things that we all feel. Alcohol, I mean, a lot of different things can really raise the risk of bleeding. And I think that it's a beautiful document. The European Heart Rhythm Practical Guide in AF goes through all of these things. Safety checks at home, making sure our patients have rubber-soled shoes, no loose carpeting, minimizing falls. But it's a really wonderful checkbox. And I think I would encourage people just download it.
Yeah, those practical points are really good ones, too. Yeah. Some thing that we don't always tell our patients, but really should. Yeah, one other thing as well in these guidelines is they do just mention the possibility of left atrial appendage occlusion too. That is a bit more of a long story to try to figure out how to integrate that into practice, but potentially in a patient that's at very high bleeding risk, is unable to tolerate anticoagulation for the long term, you know, it's an option to consider. Though at least the current guidelines and package inserts for those devices say you have to be on antithrombotic therapy for a period of time after implant. That makes it a little trickier.
Terrific. Well, we're having so much good discussion, we probably should, we have lots to cover. We'll show briefly, Christian Ruff did a nice meta-analysis of stroke reduction, and this has been seen across the different trials and the combined at the bottom, a wonderful advance, and this is compared with warfarin. So the next slide after this looks at the safety, I believe, so if we can, there on bleeding, that there's an advantage on bleeding. And, you know, in part it may be less variability, but I think also certainly for intracranial hemorrhage, an advantage of preventing intracranial hemorrhage with the NOACs.
And that's a big deal because that translates into reduction in all-cause mortality. It's about a 50% reduction intracranial hemorrhage, so ultimately about a 10% reduction all-cause mortality. So makes for a really appealing prospect
right,
to switch.
But you know, the other important thing is to, you know, the GI bleeding, again, it's not intracranial hemorrhage. Thank God that's a rarer outcome of being on an anticoagulant. It was reduced by 50% by these new agents. But also important to embrace, unfortunately, we didn't get it all. We didn't get the blue sky with these drugs either, because the gastrointestinal bleeding is something we still have to figure out, we have to solve. And just again for our viewers, is that the patient populations in each of these trials was different. And the Rocket Atrial Fibrillation trial, for example, their patient population had a CHADS score, I think, of average 3.5. The Engage AF TIMI trial was a average CHADS, not CHADS VASC, CHADS score of 2.8. And Aristotle and the RELY study about CHADS of 2.1. So even though this was a very well done study, bringing it all together by Christian, I mean, it's not as simple as just looking at these and making big decisions, because the patient populations were a bit different, and that may, at least to some degree, have shaped some of the results.
Yeah. And what about persistence, Elaine? You know, one of the key is trying to make sure that people can get the long-term prevention, and we see some differences across the different classes and agents.
So this is just one study. I think there's many studies now coming out looking at, well, once we prescribe these medicines, are patients able to stay on them? And I think, you know, overall at the six-month mark, about three-quarters, more than that, 78%, you can see. But I think across the board, to me, it's concerning that we dropped down to like 70, 60% at 1 year of patients being on these medicines. And I think that we really need to fully understand that. These patients aren't really being followed in an anticoagulation clinic where they're being pestered every month. Are you on your medicine? Are you getting your INR checked? I think patients might be making decisions because their pulse seems regular. It seems regular today. Why do I need this medicine? I'm not in that other rhythm anymore. Maybe they're stopping the medicine. Maybe they see scary ads on television. or, you know, other things are just the polypharmacy and the cost, I think, just starts to build. And so individuals will start, you know, doing it every other day to kind of not go into that donut hole. And I think it's complicated. But this, to me, is one of the biggest challenges in cardiovascular health.
Oh, absolutely.
Is persistence.
It might be a little bruising or something that we might not think, oh, that's a big deal. It's not really bleeding. It's just some bruising. But the patient might perceive it as a risk for major bleeding yet to come. So yeah, I think there needs to be a lot of care and education just around the potential side effects, potential bleeding, what's bad bleeding, you know, what might be more sort of tolerable bleeding.
The other aspect is the dose, and you know, with the warfarin, it's titrated to the INR. Sometimes people aim low, but with the NOACs, often people are put on by us, the doctors, too low a dose. And can you speak to how often that occurs?
Well, you know, let me just say that the estimates of using the low dose are a little bit different. Globally, with the lower doses of certainly apixaban, dabigatran, and rivaroxaban, Germany, France, Japan, name the country, it's about 40 to 50% are using the low dose. I think physicians fear that, you know, if a bleeding event occurs, it's my fault. But somehow if someone has a stroke, it's just sort of fate. Or, I mean, I don't know how doctors think. They think that by choosing the lower dose, 2.5 twice a day, for example, of apixaban, that they're appropriately running through the raindrops with patients that are very complex, not to say. But we know that there is a real trade-off when we're choosing the lowest dose. And I would have to say the Engage-AF study really showed us that there's a floor to, you know, how low you can go before you lose the efficacy. And in that low-dose arm strategy with edoxaban, I mean, the compared to vitamin K antagonists, the risk of ischemic stroke was increased by 40%. And then being in an academic medical center, I always tell our residents and junior faculty that when you're consuming the data, read the method sections of those papers, because if in that registry, that big data study, you know, if they're not telling you the doses that those patients were taking, it's very difficult to interpret the bleeding rates and the ischemic stroke rate. So again, just sort of a caution as to why in the United States we seem to be using apixaban in the low dose about 25% of the time. And fascinating with the dabigatran, we did not get the 110 dose in the United States, but we got this 75 milligram dose, which was only for individuals with really severe renal disease. And how we're using that in the U.S. is also a bit of a conundrum.
Yeah. And actually, Deepak, do you want to review some of the data that talks about underdosing and by the different risk patient populations?
Sure. And the data here just amplify the point that Elaine nicely made, which is that there's a lot of underdosing going on out there. And it's sort of inappropriate underdosing. That is, it would be fine to dose appropriately if someone has renal dysfunction. And the package inserts and guidelines are very clear about how to do that. But the underdosing, I think, as she pointed out, really has more to do with fear of bleeding and not necessarily related to patient risk. And, you know, one thing I've seen a lot of is older patients where even if the renal function's reasonably well preserved, they're underdosed because of fear of bleeding. But, of course, those are the patients that are particularly high stroke risk. So it really is a challenge there.
Yeah. And then the converse of that is in a renally compromised patient, overdosing, that also happens. And so this dose is really a key thing. You want to touch on these
things? Well, I think the overdosing, I can understand the underdosing because physicians did the same thing with INR targets with warfarin of 1.5 to 2.5 or 2 to 2.5. The overdosing, I think, is really, is even, you know, the same concern because, one, our doctor's calculating a creatinine clearance. You can't just eyeball a creatinine value in someone who's 80, 85, a creatinine of 0.8 and say, oh, the kidney function seems to be okay. You really need, except for apixaban, where there was a cutoff of a 1.5, the other agents, other studies use the creatinine clearance using the Cockcroft-Gault equation, and I think that's critical. So some of this overdosing may be physicians kind of not really calculating, but looking at a creatinine. The other issue here may be that for patients with fluctuating renal dysfunction or acute kidney injury, that, you know, there probably is a safe, or a, what should I say, not safe, but an interval of testing the creatinine clearance in these patients on drugs that are being renally cleared. Yeah. So we've gotten away from monitoring the INR with warfarin every 2 to 3 weeks, but we can't lose sight of individuals, you know, heart failure, you know, potent diuretics, you know, just not taking in, you know, good oral intake. I mean, those patients should be followed a little bit more closely. Maybe every 4 months would make sense to make sure that you don't get stuck with a patient being on a dose where they perhaps should be on the lower dose.
And of course, these are all older patients that start with sort of lower creatinine clearance to begin with. And, you know, I've had that happen to myself of too long an interval and, you know, presenting with bleeding. So.
Right. Or some intercurrent illness comes up, or they start an NSAID, even though Elaine said not to, because of GI bleeding, but then that affects their creatinine. So all sorts of stuff can happen. Yeah. So unless you're keeping a close eye on the creatinine, especially during those periods of transitions of health, bad stuff can happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to quickly touch on a very high-risk group and those that have both non-valvular atrial fibrillation and PCI, and you need dual antiplatelet therapy for the PCI, and so then you're left with triple therapy. And this has been an area where we know there's just going to be too much bleeding. And Deepak, you led a meta-analysis of the trials to date. Do you want to walk through this slide?
Yeah, absolutely. And this incorporates really all the key trials like ISAR triple, WOST, Pioneer, and the one that you led, of course, Redual PCI. And taken together as a class, these NOACs reduce TIMI bleeding by a substantial amount versus conventional triple therapy. So a strategy largely of double therapy, an antiplatelet plus an anticoagulant, beats dual antiplatelet therapy plus, you know, full dose warfarin. And is there any downside to that? Well, at least when you pull all these data together, thousands of patients, not tens of thousands of patients, but thousands of patients, we don't see a signal with respect to higher rates of mortality or myocardial infarction or stent thrombosis or stroke. So there doesn't seem to be a trade-off that we can detect with respect to thromboembolic complications such as stroke or coronary complications such as stent thrombosis. So I think for the majority of patients with AFib who end up needing a stent, the strategy that's best is a default strategy of triple therapy in the hospital. So for example, aspirin, clopidogrel, plus appropriately renally dosed NOAC, followed by discharge on just two agents, typically clopidogrel and then the NOAC.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I'll just share the guidelines just updated. This was updated in August, where the options there that you laid out of triple therapy on the left is one, and then thinking about dual therapy as an approach, either do triple therapy they offered for 1 month and then switching to dual therapy. And then on the next slide, we had in the North American side of things, we were both a part of this discussion looking over the data that now with the data that you just had in that meta-analysis, we notion of a default strategy of the dual therapy. But then, of course, leaving some risk stratification. If someone just had a left main stent and it was sort of a younger, lower bleeding risk, but very high thrombotic risk, you know, there you'd say, let's do some triple therapy for a period of time. And I think that notion with reasonable evidence base and another trial coming early next year will be exciting.
Great.
So we'll move on to, I think, the next segment in learning objective four that we'll talk about moving on to incorporating the use of digital health tools. And I talked about how we have lots of them available to everyone, and so want to make sure to share all those with. And that can really facilitate a collaborative care approach to try and optimize treatments for patients. So we'll start with our final question here, asking the question of, do you incorporate digital health tools, either web-based apps or smartphone apps or e-consults in the management of atrial fibrillation? And ranges from 0 to 100%, so we'll be interested to see what's our current use, and I think this will obviously evolve over time. Why don't we start the discussion with shared decision making, which is a key buzzword to say that we should work with our patients, but how does this fit in for an AFib patient? Elaine, is that something that you would do in the office?
Well, I mean, the concept of shared decision making, I would certainly hope that that's been the way I've been practicing for the last 20 years. But I think shared decision making is like a formalized exercise, which I think is important because it's making sure that our patients, you know, aren't listening to some paternalistic doctor, but are actually armed with the facts themselves. And then together, the patient and the physician can discuss, should I be worried about that? Well, probably not really. Well, how do I put this in perspective? What are my risks? And I think that it's really become a critical component of performance measuring is having these types of tools available for AF. So I do think that they clearly have a role in practice.
Yeah. Well, there are some studies that are just getting started. You want to comment on this? Ask the question of
So, you know, why are these coming about? I think they're coming about because it's all about patient education, patient education, patient education. So I'm all for it. But I get a little bit nervous looking at this study, anticoagulation choice, two components, calculating that CHADS VAS score, which has a lot of evidence for it, and that bleeding. And remember, we talked about, calculating the bleeding score, and I would want to be certain that this study is being, you know, really transparent about, you know, a bleed, although scary for a patient, it's really never going to have the lasting deficit of an ischemic stroke, so that it's not a simple calculation and comparing a CHADS VASC of 4, a HASBLED of 4, or a HASBLED of 5 or 3 or 2 on the CHADS VASC. So that's my only hope, because those factors overlap. Its bleeding has age in it, it has hypertension in it, it has prior stroke in it. Many of those overlap with the CHADS VASC, so I think it's just important. I use the HASBLED score as a checklist to make sure I'm controlling the blood pressure, making sure the D, that my patient isn't on a drug like ibuprofen that's going to increase the risk of bleeding. So I use it as sort of a flag to make sure that among these factors that we have control over, that we're actually doing something about it.
Oh, terrific. Well, there's another study we noticed. Deepak, do you want to comment on this next slide that looks again at whether digital tools could facilitate this process?
Yeah, so another interesting study called Impact AF, and it's looking at electronic clinical decision support systems to see if they can improve in a primary care setting care of these sorts of folks. And it includes all sorts of nifty things, a patient-specific software app that can run on a smartphone or on a PC for that matter. It allows patients to track their heart rate, their blood pressure, that gets relayed to their healthcare provider. So, it seems like a useful sort of strategy. Patients can also record out-of-pocket expenses and sort of issues that arise from, you know, measuring their INR, not being able to show up to work and that sort of thing. So it could give then their healthcare provider a sense of exactly what's going on in their life in terms of their AFib and, you know, what changes might be done. And I think it might be a good way to bring in the patient.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's been a recent review that talks about what are the potential here. Do you want to talk about, is this for real? We put a question mark, and it's early, I think.
Well, the problem with this field, of course, is there's a lot of excitement. And I think as physicians, we need to embrace it because, as I said before, it doesn't matter whether we do or not. Our patients are already embracing it, and younger and younger generations even more so. So I think we've got to be on board. But what we've got to try to do is, you know, before the genie's completely out of the bottle, you know, try to study these different modalities and see if they really improve outcomes. And, you know, here was a study, for example, or an article claiming, you know, that there's going to be mortality reductions with these sorts of digital health approaches. And that might be true. Intuitively, I would like to think that's true. But we don't need to prove it before saying things like that. Otherwise, there's some risk of hyping the field before it really has time to mature.
Yeah. Well, I'll go quickly through these. The ESC has several apps for patients and providers. And, you know, you can see a display of these here of MyAF would be for the patient and then AFib Manager and, you know, has all the risk stratification tools. I think the next slide also then has a depiction of some of the other tools that the ESC has. And so I think it's nice to see our societies are providing these apps. So the next segment is to look at access to cardiologists and specialists. How does that relate? And this was an interesting study that looked at the density of cardiologists in the region. And the middle bullet there looked in patients with MI and heart failure, so not atrial fibrillation, where if there were fewer cardiologists, that was associated with like a 9% adjusted difference in mortality. So suggesting that availability of more advanced care and cardiologists may relate to outcomes and a similar finding in AFib. I think these are just observational analysis, but I think speaking to this is a multifactorial disease and we have to take it seriously.
Right, and I also want to make a plea, though, because, you know, if we're holding ourselves out as nurse practitioners or physician assistants or, you know, the primary care physician, the general internist, you know, step up because, you know, if you have these patients, I mean, you need to be doing the simple stuff like the CHADS VAS score, sitting down with a patient and getting them, I would say, that day. And also, of course, get your cardiology consult, your specialist, my two friends here involved. But my goodness, we're physicians, and I think that first thing, we have to recognize it and we have to know what to do, including consult our colleagues.
Yeah. So one of the ways to build a care group is, I think, based at where you are, but then availability of specialists by e-consults is a growing field. I know colleagues have done an analysis, just at the Mass General, even of access there by a time, right. not a distance barrier. Do you want to comment, Deepak, on the potential here?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's a lot of potential for e-consults. Actually, back when I was chief of cardiology at the VA here in town, I was tasked with setting up the e-consult service for cardiology, and there, you know, you both know this well, you know, we've got veterans coming in from Maine and all sorts of places, and, you know, having an e-consult service can really help. But even more locally, it can speed up the time to actually getting that opinion. And, you know, a lot of things don't really need a face-to-face, and even if they do, there are ways of remotely checking in on patients with current video technology. So I think there's the opportunity, at least, to improve outcomes, certainly access to care, increase patient satisfaction. Somebody doesn't have to drive in or wait 3 months for an appointment. That can make them happy. And it can improve specialist access. It might even, you know, decrease the cost of care. And it doesn't mean that there won't always still need to be a follow-up in-person visit, but, you know, at least as a first triaging mechanism, it can be quite effective.
Yeah. I called out in the beginning the fact that our CME provider has developed collaboration, and these are the notion of an e-consult, that you would connect primary care physicians with board-certified specialists, and so they've arranged for one of these services to be available for the first 100 participants who sign up, and so definitely encourage you to think about that as an option for you. And you can see an array of Arista MD is one company, but then several others have developed this service. I think on the patient side of things, we talked also about really empowering the patient as a key part of this. And so here's a coaching program that's a 12-week program. And this is probably the Koumanen Clinic sort of applied to total care, where you get someone to talk through and discuss. And, you know, this notion has been seen in other settings to increase treatment adherence. Mm-hmm. And so the next slide, this also is available for the first 75 patients to get referred to this. And again, some of the numbers that support prior work in this field of increasing medication adherence with a program like this, and certainly patient satisfaction, I think, goes up, and awareness. And so I think it's an exciting thing to see these benefits. We talked about a whiteboard for patients, and so this is a little screenshot of this, that this is available. You can download, show it on an iPad for patients that have atrial fibrillation, certainly new diagnosis. This would be a great way, and there's also a downloadable set of questions to ask and really start give the domain of what are the topics that we need to worry about with atrial fibrillation. And so the final slide is one that has a good acronym of having SMART goals for this. And Deepak, do you want to comment on what we would be aiming for with all these tools?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the bottom line is we want to try to implement evidence-based screening tools and figure out ways to identify who's at risk for AF. That's really the goal here. And then to make it actionable, that is not just to diagnose, but to treat where appropriate. And as we discussed, for the majority of folks that have real AF and CHADS-VAS scores of 2 or above, and I think all of us actually said one or above, you know, anticoagulation would seem in order, again, barring some contraindication. And potentially then, you know, incorporating these different digital tools we've discussed and others might facilitate guideline-directed care, shared decision-making, and ultimately improve quality of life for patients. Doesn't mean that we don't need more data on how to refine those strategies, make sure they're cost-effective, but certainly the field is moving in that direction.
Terrific. Well, I hear that we have lots of questions. I want to welcome everyone to our question and answer period. I apologize that we've run a little over on the first thing, but we've got lots of terrific questions, and I want to jump right in. And I'll put the first question to you, Elaine. Why do women get a point in the CHA2DS2-VASc score?
Well, there's, I think, been several studies that have demonstrated that for different changes, whether they're estrogen deprivation or whatever, but several papers of which I'm familiar because I was one of the many authors on the one especially, really looking just at differences in platelet aggregability and I think other things that when we get up into this older age, remember that that female risk factor really doesn't kick in, I should say, until we're over age 65. But I do think there's good biology to support that.
Okay. Another question that comes up in the treatment, what about vitamin K antagonists for stroke prevention? We didn't touch on that, we kind of jumped ahead, but how good are the data for stroke prevention for vitamin K antagonists?
Really good. I mean, there's nothing wrong with using the many places in the world that's still the standard of care. I guess we focused on NOACs just because they're better for the reasons outlined in terms of less intracranial hemorrhage, easier to use, but certainly they're more expensive. That's why they're not used in all regions of the world. And there's some patients who still can't, you know, take them if they've got a mechanical heart valve, moderate or severe mitral stenosis, or, you know, a few other reasons. So, you know, warfarin's not gone away. There are other uses for it as well. Then what I outlined, pulmonary embolus, DVT, though even there, NOACs are gaining or have gained a lot of traction. But still, because of cost and global availability, it's not going away anytime too soon.
Yeah, and you know, from a magnitude, it's a 66%, I want to say. So that's like bigger than anything else, you know, that generally we'll see a 15 or 20% reduction in events, and this is three times that. So it's a huge benefit.
Right, and I would say even though, you know, the guidelines, you know, clearly are favoring NOACs, because I do think that the lack of the interference with vitamin K, the green leafy vegetables, you know, it really does, I think, have interference with multiple different medications. There still are patients that I think are going to remain on vitamin K antagonists. Certainly there's controversy about the very obese patients, you know, BMIs over 40. There's been some question about whether or not that we should be extrapolating all of the trial data to that group of individuals. I think that's fair, and we need to study that more. And there were other patients, you know, liver disease is another act of malignancy. We need more information about the efficacy of using these drugs in those different patient populations.
Yeah, and you know, people have asked about high-risk patients such as diabetes, prior coronary disease, and stroke, and then the renally impaired patient. I think we've talked about dose. Is it safe to use these in renally impaired patients?
That's interesting, because if you look at the warfarin data, warfarin doesn't look that great in really impaired patients either, you know. I mean, of course, we've got to do what we've got to do. And I think, you know, carefully dosed NOACs, at least in moderate renal dysfunction, still beat warfarin, but it needs to be carefully done. That is, you can't just start the dose and not monitor the renal function for a year. As we discussed earlier, that's where you run into trouble.
Yeah.
And there's also some studies going on now, even in patients with really marked renal dysfunction or even on dialysis, that should report in the next year or two. So we'll
right,
have a lot
so
more
that study is renal AF, and I believe that probably should be out next year. There was a study just published in Circulation, but it was a registry study, so that I think we're all eager to see. You know, remember, the FDA on zero data gave a green light to the use of apixaban in end-stage renal disease patients on hemodialysis, and so I don't think anyone's been using it until we actually get some evidence for that.
I've got to confess, I've actually done it.
You know, the other thing is be smart. I mean, know the degree of renal clearance for these different drugs. Dabigatran is 80%, rivaroxaban 36%, apixaban 25%, edoxaban 50%. So, you know, that's the amount of that drug that's being cleared through the kidney. So, I mean, some of this is just being a good physician and choosing the right medicine for the right patient.
Yeah. We have so many questions on dose, and I think it is key that on the one hand, it's easy for the NOACs, but it's really the renal function and adjustment. And I then always go to what's the label say, and it's, you know, very frequently I pull up and I want to make sure I get the criteria just right, and is a key thing. Is there any, someone asked about someone with a history of GI bleed, would one adjust a dose of apixaban if you had AFib and a history of a GI bleed?
So, you know, that is absolutely not what you would want to do, is adjust the dose. I mean, obviously the first thing is to understand why this patient is having a GI bleed. My own parent had a GI bleed because, you know, my mom was taking ibuprofen in conjunction with her blood thinner, unbeknownst to her daughter. And that's why, you know, she sustained a GI bleed. So I think first is diagnosis. I mean, these patients should be up to date on their colon cancer screening, colonoscopy. You know, just doing, being good practice, I think will help. But there's been multiple studies, and Deepak certainly knows a ton of them as well, that have looked at individuals who've even had their anticoagulant stopped, let's say after four polyps were removed or not restarted. And every vascular bed that you want to study, if you stop the anticoagulant, the mortality and the thrombosis really spikes after that. And I think that that's a lesson to learn. After the GI bleed, that I rarely will permanently stop anyone's anticoagulant after a GI bleed.
Yeah, the only other point I'll make is if they're at high risk of upper GI bleeding, a proton pump inhibitor can diminish that risk. So something to consider.
Yeah. Well, you know, you just answered three of the other questions that were here. Is there any sort of magic thing that we could help tell patients about this issue of not stopping? You know, what could really share with them the danger, I suppose, of stopping?
So I really, I mean, this may sound awful, but I'm very, very honest with my patient, and I make them understand, you know, do you know anyone in your family who's had a stroke? Are you familiar with that is like? Because when you look at patient surveys, patients would much rather have, you know, four, six GI bleeds than an ischemic stroke that makes them dependent on their loved ones. And I think that that's important.
All right. Well, thank you all very much for joining today's program. It's been a delight doing it with you.